So as Braxton said, the topic for tonight is the question of free will in the modern world. So basically, I'll provide a view of free will that can be interpreted as following after a perennial philosophical tradition, for example, inspired by Aristotelian Thomistic contributions to this topic, and see how it might be helpful for understanding the issue of free will within a contemporary context. So first we'll begin with just the common everyday person's assumptions about free will. In fact, far from being a merely academic question, it turns out that free will is a valuable, intuitive, and meaningful notion that does a good job of making sense of our own personal experience and our judgment of the behavior of others. Here on the slide are three ideas we commonly associate with free will. First, we have the ability to actualize distinct possibilities. In other words, we participate in making a difference in the world by bringing out things that could be. Not only this, but we stand simultaneously to multiple possibilities, one of which becomes a reality because of our own free choice. Two, the second bullet point, that we have some degree of autonomy. We are to some degree self-directing and self-governing as opposed to being merely exercised by external causes and factors. So something that's contributed from us that we would say as a whole or as a person and not merely as a sort of a fluctuation out from prior principles, let's say compositional principles that make up our person. Three, we are responsible for our choices. We regret our previous bad choices because we know we are responsible for them, and this because we have free will. Not only are these common ideas associated with free will, but I think that they present a correct conception of free will, generally. Human beings are generally responsible for their actions, they have a meaningful degree of autonomy, and they are able to actualize distinct possibilities. That these views about free will and human behavior are rather natural is shown in how they consistently affect the interactions with ourselves and others. They're sort of control concepts that help us in understanding ourselves as well as others. For example, there are cases of tragic ill effects for those who lack a sense of personal free will. Jeffrey Dahmer and the Marquis de Sade, for example, are two infamous people who claimed no sense of true freedom in their lives. Regarding the social function that the conception of free will plays, the philosopher P.F. Strawson has pointed out that in general, we tend to depersonalize individuals when we find out that their actions were non-free. For example, imagine a scenario with a friend of yours that you haven't seen in a while, in which you call him over to chat, and without saying a word, he shoves you to the floor. Your immediate response would be something like, "Why would that person ever do that to me? I thought we were friends. What have I done to him to deserve this treatment? And they shouldn't be so mean to me." You know, you can think of these sorts of responses. After this event, however, you come to find out that your friend has had an unfortunate psychological breakdown for some reason. It is at that time that your relationship to him changes regarding that event. Instead of relating that action in personal terms, we have a tendency to switch to a more impersonal understanding of them, such as their brain is malfunctioning, or they have a chemical imbalance, or they're exhibiting compulsive behavior, etc. So in this way, there is a direct relationship, it seems, between the notion of free action and the notion of interpersonal interaction. To provide some orientation as we go through this fairly involved section coming up, I want to identify a few ultimate conclusions about free will. The first bullet point: free will involves contingency without being arbitrary and is determinative without being deterministic. This view of free will addresses a false dichotomy, I think, between actions as determinative or arbitrary. Free will has similarities and differences with both of these features. This addresses a dilemma that is posed to views that is often used to criticize views of free will. Either there is a prior cause that brings about the action that we call free, or there is no prior cause. Both scenarios seem to take away free will. Either it is predetermined or it is random, neither which seem to be a mark of a genuine autonomous and free action. The second bullet point. Free will is our capacity to engage in particular actions beyond an indifferent generic cognitive state. This tells us a little more about what in fact free will is. Peter VandenWagen once opined in his book on free will that although he knows that we have free will, he has no idea what it is. This, I conject, tells us something about what it is. Namely, it's this ability to go beyond this indifferent sort of cognitive generic state to a particular action. We shall test this view of free will at the end of the presentation in light of some criticisms of the reality of free will. So the next several slides examine the nature and possibility of free will. This will entail examining the nature of free will in light of basic considerations of human nature and a deeper examination of the integrated and fundamental characteristics that go into building an account of free will. And I'll be honest with you right from the start, we're going to do a kind of a deep philosophical dive that might smack a sort of modern empiricist as being implausible. But I think that this, as Aristotle would say, is an account of human nature that saves the phenomenon, right beyond that which we're sort of told is not possible on a purely empirical methodology. So let's start with a rather classic, albeit fairly nominal, definition of free will. This is number one. Free will is the ability to do otherwise, or the ability to take one thing while refusing another. This is that related to that idea of there being simultaneous contrary possibilities that exist with respect to the person and their choices. To clarify, this definition doesn't explicitly include the idea that free will is the choice to do what is ultimately good, and a lack of free will as doing what is ultimately bad. This is sometimes how we use the term free will. For example, you may hear someone say something like, although his wild and wicked lifestyle is what he has chosen, he is not free, since he will never achieve happiness through such pursuits. On the definition we're using tonight, since he had the ability to do otherwise than he in fact did, he was indeed free, even though in this other sense, he was not. At this point, since free choice is something that human beings do, and is in fact a special feature of human beings, we need to dip our toe into a general account of human nature. An account that, once again, will make sense of the range of human behaviors they exhibit and experience, as I said, in this Aristotelian sense of saving the phenomenon. What they're really after here is a sense of the fundamental principles that compose a human being and how these principles interact to make sense of how free will might work. Views of the human person include dualism and materialism, both of which you're probably familiar with, right? Materialism is the view that we're made up of matter, and these material principles will interact in certain ways to exhibit the behavior of the whole, for example. Or dualism, right? There's substance dualism, two different substances, the soul and the body, and there's a kind of interaction between the two. However, a less familiar view, but one that is gaining more and more purchase in contemporary literature and metaphysics, is the view called hylomorphism, originally developed by Aristotle. This view of hylomorphism of Aristotle was consistently articulated through the Middle Ages. On hylomorphism, the person is made up of soul and body, and the soul is the fundamental part of the whole by which the body realizes its own identity as reflecting the whole. In other words, the body is ordered to the soul. One way to think about hylomorphism is like the relationship between an idealized triangle and a representation of this triangle, say in a chalkboard. The perfect triangle is like the soul, and the representation on the board is like the body. The idealized triangle is a special principle of the triangle and has a completeness, but so does the image of the triangle on the board. The difference with this example and the body-soul composition of the human being is that the human body is not just a representation of the soul, but a compositional principle along with the soul of the person. Now, of course, you can probably be thinking right now this is a very complicated relationship, and I think that's a fair criticism, and in fact, probably one of the strongest criticisms of hylomorphism today is that the worry that it perhaps is incoherent. A particular physical body is a presentation of the soul at a particular time, but this presentation changes as our bodies change in various ways. So that's another sort of way of getting at the idea of hylomorphism. Another way to delve into the hylomorphic account that goes further towards an account of free will and is a special adaptation from hylomorphism that is especially helpful with the idea of free will is to think about the soul as a part of the whole that identifies the whole above and beyond the distinct parts that make the person up. So the soul strangely represents the whole, even though it makes up only a part. So two, the soul is a special part of the person such that the act of the soul is properly the act of the human being as a whole. This is possible on hylomorphism since the soul is the principle of unified action and the being of the whole. Its action is of the whole person because the soul excels matter in its operational power and the character of the body is itself ordered to the soul. This is where you get into that Aristotelian idea of actualities and potentialities, right? Lower potencies being actualized in a continuous way with the higher actualities. This hylomorphic view of the human person becomes directly relevant to free will when we think about what this entails for a causal consideration of human action. Namely, that this hylomorphic account will be an agent causation account of free will, or a form of it. This is the bullet point. Agent causation, view that the immanent cause of an action is the person as a whole. Agent causation stands in contrast with the view that an action arises in virtue of some part only or interaction among some parts, such as a particular chain of neural structures, inputs and outputs. So on this alternative view to agent causation, you have a particular part or a chain of actions of a part of the human being, and they account for the action of the whole. So a particular neuro firing causing the action of the human being. This would seem to be the kind of account you get from, let's say, a materialistic account, which seems to have trouble accounting for the action of the whole as whole. It's a famous problem. Having identified a general metaphysical point about human nature and human causation involving the soul and person as a whole, we now need to look at how aspects of the soul interact to produce an action. A major point along these lines is three. Free will is necessarily dependent upon intellectual operations. Sort of a key, sort of Thomistic idea here. This is illustrated in the diagram. The functional movement from the object to the intellect to the will and back to the object again. Truth is the relation between the object and the intellect, and goodness is the relation from will back to the object. The key movement to show the dependence that the will has on the intellect is from the intellect to the will. Although the will has the intelligible good as its object, the will itself is blind to such externally existing goodness and needs to have the intellect posit this to the will for it to be actually drawn towards these particular good things. Just as to give a kind of concrete example, it's a hot summer day, you have the ice cream out there, the ice cream is the object. The intellect, you come to have a cognitive relationship to this thing, right? You identify a bunch of different properties about the object. It's cool, it's sweet, it has nutritional value, right? It's a nice social opportunity with your family, etc. Okay, there's a list of truths that you relate to this ice cream. that's posited to the will. The will is sort of in the background until the goodness of that object, the properties of that object is posited to it. Then that's enlivened to move the human back to the object. Okay? The job of the will is to move back to the object and to execute the action. What this dependency tells us, though, is that there will always be a reason for our actions. In other words, when asked why someone performed a certain action, it will never be sufficient to respond with, "I did it because I chose to, despite having no compelling reason to do it." Of course, we can understand that even that could be a reason, right? You're trying to show someone, your philosophy professor, right, that you can act in a way without reasons. That in itself can constitute a reason for your action. Beyond the interplay of the will and the intellect, there are levels to the intellectual operations itself. I love this animation. I could stare at it all day. These levels of intellect will be relevant in our understanding of will and free will. First, there's the level of simple abstraction, in which generic features are identified in things. Some things are understood as being food, for example. Next, we compare these generic features with each other to formulate assertions such as this food is delicious or this food is not healthy, etc. So we're comparing, contrasting these generic features. Finally, we think about how these assertions relate to each other to formulate new assertions such as the relationship between, for example, all pleasurable things are to be pursued, for example, let's say someone has that assertion, and that delicious cake is pleasurable to eat. This will lead to the new assertion that delicious cake is to be pursued. So this is Aristotle's sort of practical theory of practical judgment. Of particular importance, though, is the initial stage that colors all stages of intellection prior to choice, namely abstraction. In fact, free will be seen as a complementary function to the abstract nature that characterizes the intellectual state. Specifically, a key feature of abstraction is that apprehension of a feature is indifferent to what falls under it. This is essentially what abstraction is, right? Food is indifferent in a special way to the two things that fall underneath it. A key idea in abstraction is this idea of indifference. So if you look at the diagram, food, if you think about it, food is and is not salad. Food is said truly of peanut butter and jelly, but is said of other things as well. Food is sort of vaguely related to these objects, rather indifferent to PB&J and salad. In fact, this is true not only of generic concepts, but of particular instances as well. Food is and is not this bowl of salad before you. In this intriguing situation, there are two relations at play. Namely, one that I call the bottom-up relation, from one of the branches up to its genus. With the bottom-up relation, so from the salad, for example, up to food, with the bottom-up relation, there is an unambiguous path from one of the branches to its genus, since included in the very idea of that branch, namely salad, is the member above it. So food is included in the notion of salad. However, there is also another important relation, which is what I call the side-to-side relation. This is the relation of the generic to its opposing differences. Food is equally, indifferently, and ambiguously related to PB&J and salad. In this relation, due to the abstract nature of the generic concept, there is no unambiguous path to either difference from the genus. So you can't get from food to one of the two alternatives. Free choice makes a special appearance at the level of intellectual judgment and is a place where we see the complementarity between intellectual and volitional aspects of human action. So under judgment, it says, one deliberates on the variety of assertions, the termination of which is a chosen action, which is properly called deliberation. So let's say someone chooses to eat a second piece of chocolate cake. She eats it, say, after thinking about it, because eating sweet things are pleasant and chocolate cake is sweet. She decides not to go for the healthy choice, which is not so obviously pleasant, but would otherwise have had a perfectly good reason for abstaining from the second piece of cake. So the second sentence is, when doing so, a person is not choosing beyond reasons, but rather choosing among reasons. Necessarily, the executed choice involves both the bottom-up relation of the branches to its genus, and now a direct, determined path from the generic to only one of the two side-to-side relations represented as one of the branches. In this way, due to the bottom-up relation, a judgment necessarily has a reason. And yet it is free because the indifference of the side-to-side relation was removed by choosing one side and not the other. Of course, this is usually much more complicated. The reason the chocolate cake eater chose the food she did was because it tastes yummy instead of being healthy. However, at the end of the day, the reason for acting is because food is good and eating pleasant things are good, but so are doing things that are healthy. The top-bottom relation and the side-to-side relation are both at play in the anatomy of that choice. The final point to be made about the dependence of the will and the intellect is as follows. What are we ultimately after, and how is this related to our intellect? Since goodness is what we always seek and can only be identified through the intellect, everything we do is for a reason. In other words, reason applied to action is just the way of finding the pathway to what is fundamentally good. Of course, we're not always successful. Not always successful to find the actual good. As a result, to do something just because it is evil is just as impossible as doing something just because it is irrational. So given the strong view presented on the last slide, we're left with the question. Since the will is dependent on the intellect to identify what is good, and action involves the rational process of deliberation, do we even need the idea of free will? After all, couldn't we just think of there being an inner process in which we make comparisons and force to pick the one with the most compelling reason? Not at all. Remember about the nature of the relation between the bottom-up and the side-to-side relations of differences. Reason is not going to be sufficient to choose because in addition to the bottom-up relation, there's that ambiguous side-to-side relation of the differences to its generic parent. We begin with the intellect, and the intellect resides in the realm of abstraction, which is fundamentally indifferent to the opposing branches falling under it. Therefore, we have four evidence for free will as a distinct power from our intellect. Our intrinsic ability to perform one particular action versus another when those actions are indifferent at the generic level. So I have a nicely vivid thought experiment, which you may be familiar with, to motivate this idea that goes back to the 14th century philosopher John Bird, referred to as Burden's donkey or Burden's ass. So in this case, you have this donkey tired out from a long day of, you know, grinding at the mill, turning the grind mill, and it's ready to come back to the barn for the day. So it walks in the barn door, and it's struck simultaneously by two delicious piles of hay, both corners of the barn. Okay, on this side, let's say 30 feet away on this side, okay, they're separate from each other. So assuming that all things being equal, so this donkey is not left hoofed versus right hoofed or has a penchant to go to one side or another, or, you know, smells one pile. All things being equal, the question is, what does the donkey do? What conclusion should we draw from this scenario? The donkey, it would seem, because all things being equal and it's equally drawn to both piles of hay, cannot make a choice to go to this pile of hay versus that pile of hay, so it would seem that the donkey would starve to death. So what conclusion would we draw from this? Namely, that the bottom-up relationship is insufficient to reduce away the left-to-right ambiguity. Literally, the piles of hay on the left and the right side of the donkey are insufficient to choose just one of them. But of course, you or I would not meet the same fate as Beared and Zass, even though we are like it in many ways, since we're constantly finding ourselves in the predicament of indifference between equal choices. Therefore, enter the distinct power of free will, a kind of complementarity power to that of intellectual abstraction. If we think about the diagram of the triangle I showed earlier again, the movement from the object to the intellect to the will and back to the object again, we see that the complete process requires entering into an abstract state by the intellectual power, but then to exit back to the concrete by free will in which a particular action is able to be executed. So just as particular objects are rendered generic and consequently indifferent to particular instances of those universal properties by way of the cognitive power, free will allows us to move back again, right, back through this state of indifference to the particular action that instantiates it. So we've been thinking about the requirement of free will over and above that of intellection to fully account for human action. At this point, we need to reflect some more about the interplay between intellect and will. But first, I need to say something brief about the function of free will in a dynamic and more concrete way, and thereby introduce a few more key terms. Like I said, I apologize for introducing all of these terms, what I was telling folks at dinner tonight. The way to understand Aquinas, the way to understand Aquinas is a very organic, in a very organic way. It's sort of unfair in a way. In order to understand principle A in Aquinas, you need to know B. In order to know B, you need to know C. In order to know C, you need to know A, right? So you just kind of have to have it all thrown at you. Okay, so five. Free will is the choice of contingent means for achieving an end which is ordered to the necessary goal of objective happiness. So here's the vocabulary terms that make up that statement. Contingent versus necessary. Contingent is an unavoidable aspect of a thing or event. Means versus ends. The former is done for the sake of the latter. And happiness, active and complete realization. So here's a little more context to give us a better understanding of the causal process involved in a free action. Immanent realism is a view which ultimately accounts for what something is, its powers, and why a thing is moved towards another. On this view, forms ultimately are principles of intelligibility, structure, and stability, and have residency directly within the world that we experience. This was seen on the triangle diagram I showed a moment ago. One is ultimately moved to things as they exist out there in the world. For example, the delicious ice cream. So how should we understand the interaction between intellect and will specifically regarding the various moving components involved that constitute the anatomy of human action itself? So so on the screen there, intellect moves the agent by identifying what action is being performed and why. That's the role of the intellect. The intellect determines what action has been performed or what action is going to be performed and for what generic reason. When looked at from this perspective, one gets a kind of static and generic feel for the role of the intellect. For example, identifying an action as an act of theft, for example. The will moves the agent by initiating an action for the sake of accomplishing something. That is, the will initiates the act in its movement towards the good and establishes the particular reason acted upon it. With this motion, we get a dynamic and concrete feel for the role of the will in action. For example, committing an act of theft for the sake of getting some much-needed quick cash. So in the spirit of the dynamic role of the will is the principle that pulls the agent past the generic limit of the intellect to a particular action. And yet determination remains ubiquitous in action as a universal covering principle. The intellect is the principle that allows the act to be fully determinative and delimited or non-arbitrary. It provides the reason for the action. But we want to make sure that we don't misrepresent the intellect and will as two independent of each other. It is too easy to characterize this view as something like, so the will is the chooser thing and the intellect is the thinker thing. Rather, the will per se act, or essential act, is the intelligible good, and this or that particular good, its per accidens act, or its accidental act. What this amounts to is that the will is always fundamentally about precisely the ultimate intelligible good. It is a rational will. It's not, for example, an appetitive will. It's a rational will. Since the intellect posits the good to the will, it moves the will as a final cause, drawing it to the things that are good. From there, the will is interested in finding the pathway up to that which terminates in the deep fundamental good in which the happiness of the individuals reside, and it does this by choosing this or that particular thing. Since goodness and truth ultimately coincide, the will is considered to be fundamentally ordered and amenable to reason, which is essential and necessary. Remember the bottom-up relation. We are interested in committing an action that leads up to what is necessarily good and related to our happiness. As the per accidens is dependent upon the per se, free will is dependent on the intellect. Thus, all free acts are delimited. So, in other words, the will will never act outside of the confines of choosing for a reason in the intelligible good. Free will regards what is contingent because instances that fall under concepts are per accidens objects of the intellect. However, this doesn't leave free will out of the cold, but plays a special role in the particular action. One does the contingent thing, the things that could have been otherwise, although it is done for the sake of being happy, which is necessary, with full understanding that it itself is not necessary for happiness. So one acts for the sake of happiness, even though the thing that is done is not recognized as being necessarily connected to happiness. For example, we choose the PB&J for the sake of our happiness, even though we know that it is contingently related to our happiness. Believe it or not, you realize that you could still be happy if you miss out on the PB&J. This is similar to the fact that a particular dog has per accidens in relation to the species of dog, since if that particular dog didn't exist, it wouldn't detract from the species of dog itself. When we look at both paragraphs on the slide then, we see that free will is kind of deterministic, but kind of arbitrary, to put it infelicitously. In other words, it is a hybrid of both. Okay, like I said, a lot of technical stuff. I'm almost done with the technical stuff, and then I'll look at some contemporary criticism. All right, so from our last point about the interplay between free will and the intellect, let's circle back to the idea that a human being is made up of soul and body in a way that allows us to bring the abstract features of the soul down to earth a little so we can look at the interplay between the will, intellect, and the body. 6, how the soul interacts with the body in an act of free choice. Remember, the soul is immaterial. The brain is the material cause of the soul. Material cause is the subject in which something exists. Soul and brain are poles. Consciousness is like the field that is generated with respect to those poles. Now, the lower structures, things like brain physiology, chemistry, and physics, are imposed upon and assimilated by the higher structures. And as such, the lower powers and structures of the brain will be integrated into the intrinsic operations of the soul that I described. A clear example of the higher integrating the lower is the realization of perception beyond that of physiological sensation. Perception requires not just inner awareness of images, but also photons hitting the retina, which are the necessary lower conditions that are integrated by the higher role of conscious perception. So an analogy to get our heads around this idea of material cause of the lower incorporated into the higher is as follows. Let's say that you planned a party. The structure of the room that you have the party in will impose lower ways or lower potencies in which that party will play out. For example, if there's a large table in the middle of the room, the flow of traffic of the party goers will be shaped by this obstacle. But at the same time, the table will be incorporated into the party, right? So placing gifts on the table, playing games on the table, etc. Okay, so let's recap. The ability to act otherwise has the whole person as its active principle, by which what is generically considered as good is superseded by a movement towards some particular good, supported by a determinative reason for the sake of happiness, and occurring within the context of a functioning brain. Okay, so now let's look at some objections to the idea of there being free will, and see if we can't bring it together with some of the things that we talked about tonight here. We begin with what I call microdeterminism, which is a determinism thought to come about as a result of the physical laws and interactions of bits of stuff under these laws, these compositional material bits, right? This determinism is commonly understood to be inconsistent with meaningful free will, the so-called incompatibilist view. So there's some ideas working at this level that seem to yield determinism. The law of conservation of energy. No energy is lost when work is done. It is only lost in that particular form. The criticism goes that actions that could have been otherwise have the soul and not the body as its source. However, in actualizing a particular course of action by soul would be outside of the energy system that is it is interacting with, thereby breaking the law of conservation of energy. The fact is, right down to the micro level, there is a finite system of particularly directed energies which cannot be messed with in any degree. Causal closure under the physical. This view holds that any physical effects must only have physical causes. And then finally, the highly predictive nature of physics. When you treat the world around you in a physically deterministic way, as science does, we unlock considerable knowledge about the world and can make super accurate predictions about future events. This is seen in Darwinism, relativity theory, the periodic table, for example, nuclear science, Newtonian physics, etc. Okay, so let's try out some responses to the microdeterminism challenge. First, the wholes versus parts ontology. The causal behavior of parts are determined by the wholes they compose, and so cannot be incompatible with the agency of the whole. So there's a lot sort of packed into that one sentence. The general idea is that we need not look only at the action of the whole in light of the action, The general idea is that we need not only look at the action of the whole in light of the action of the parts, but also the action of the parts in light of the action of the whole. It is possible they're compatible. If they're not compatible, then it would seem likely that the whole ontology should win over the parts ontology. Here's a dilemma. Either part-whole ontology is compatible or it's not. If they are, then there's no problem. If not, then the whole ontology wins, since such a theory makes sense of purposes, and parts ontology seems to not be able to make sense of purposes. But if there are no purposes, then in principle one cannot assert that the parts ontology is true, since to do so would involve a purpose. This is an argument that I adapted from Norman Malcolm. 9, indeterminism at a microphysical level. It's another way of possibly responding to microdeterminism. So this is from Sam Harris's book on free will. He says, Heisenberg has observed that certain processes in the brain occur at random and cannot therefore be determined by environmental stimuli. Although quantum indeterminism is generally unheeded in the macro world of our five senses, the brain's deep intricacies and delicacies seem to be much more open to dynamic interactions at that level. Right? So you have functions that amplify weak signals, et cetera, with cascading neural firings, et cetera. Next, we move on to macro determinism, which is also something that Harris focuses on in his book. This form of determinism eliminates meaningful free will by movement at the macrophysical level, for example, at the neurophysiological level. So, for example, Sam Harris denies, one, that each of us could have behaved differently than we did in the past. The reason he gives for this view is the following. He says, some moments before you are aware of what you will do next, your brain has already determined what you will do. You then become conscious of this decision and believe that you are in the process of making it. The basis of this assertion, sort of the genesis of this assertion, you might say, are the experiments by Libet and others since the 1960s. This is sort of crudely described. You have certain people sitting and they're hooked up to brainwave scans and they're asked to do a simple task, pushing, let's say, a green button. Okay, they mark the time when they decide to choose to hit the button. And what they find in more than 50% of the cases is that the motor cortex of the brain was already active 7 or 8 or 6 or 7 seconds prior to them deciding to press the button. Okay. So this seems to suggest what Harris is saying here, right? That your consciousness is always playing catch up to the brain's predetermined decisions. So following this, Harris draws the conclusion that your conscious mind is always playing catch up to your brain's decisions, as I just said. So what do we have to say for ourselves about this objection? Well, in support of one, namely that each of us could have behaved differently than we did in the past, there's a couple of things we can say to this. First, I think that the criticism is too optimistic about lining up brain events with mind events. This is one. The individuation of brain activity and conscious thought is not clear enough to say that one preexisted the other. Right? Just because one area of the brain lights up sort of in a previous temporal sequence of something that is occurring at the level of the mind, perhaps it's too complicated of a process to be able to make that determination. For example, you know, people that imagine themselves playing golf, etc., will have activity in the cerebral cortex. So brain activity seems to be too vague to identify with particular conscious choices. To say that the motor cortex is active is too indeterminate a power to determine the execution of a decision. Decisions are famously very complex things. For example, an act of stealing involves intention, abstraction, anticipation, memory, etc. The more complex the decision, the more vague the individuation of the brain states that would be involved in that decision will be. For example, more diverse parts of the brain will be active and interacting with each other, making it rather hard to compare the temporal ordering of the brain and mind events. The individuation of human action between brain activity and mental activity is further complicated in a kind of cyclical relationship that seems to exist between these two realms that we call the habits. This is illustrated with two. Habitual action is not contrary to free action. Just because someone lights up a cigarette habitually doesn't mean it's not an act of free choice. We let habit take over for less important things in our lives so we can focus on more important things. A good example of this is with concert musicians. They've relegated much of their action to the level of habituation so as to focus on higher goals of dynamics and interpretation of the music. Something like this is likely going on with the free choice to push the button at a certain time. This seems like a great kind of operation to relegate to a more autonomous operation in the brain. I'm going to skip this last part. This is my crazy idea. A second denial of Harris is he denies that we are conscious, that we are the conscious source of most of our thoughts and actions in the present. He suggests that if we are honest about our own experience of ourselves, we'll admit our thought that our thought life is rather random and not within our control. He says, I cannot decide what I will think or intend until a thought or intention arises. What will my next mental state be? I do not know. It just happens. Where is the freedom of that? The particular intentions, perspectives, and attitudes in these thoughts do not seem to come from us. Almost like we're watching a movie directed, scripted, and produced by someone else. And that, of course, like a bad 1950s sci-fi movie, is dun-dun-dun, the brain. In response to this, I don't think that this is 100% bad news. It makes sense to me to admit that we aren't the conscious source of many of our thoughts and actions in the present, and that's why I change it. That's why I changed it on the slide there by dropping the word conscious on the left hand, on the left side. That's why I put an asterisk. So we are the source of most of our thoughts and actions in the present, instead of conscious. As soul-body unities, although sometimes mysterious, our thoughts belong to us involving reverberations of past actions. Indeed, we are not perfectly transparent to ourselves. We are not moments in time, but complexes of past experiences and decisions. And yet many of the thoughts that crowd our minds are consequences of previously conscious actions that we made in part at an earlier time. But at the end of the day, freedom is realized as the soul acting for the whole person within the scope of self-determination. We have souls that account for our whole personhood, and we can act for the sake of the whole in a way that is neither deterministic nor arbitrary, as I argued. In fact, the concept of self-determination is really a synonym for these two features. So Harris's criticism isn't so bad after all. Couple more slides and I'm done. Here are some specifically philosophical criticisms of the possibility of free will. The first criticism I refer to as free choice implies an infinite regress. This is a well-known argument. Specific actions committed flow from one's character, but one's character is shaped by previous actions, which were dependent on a still prior character. Thus, there is either an infinite regress or of prior actions that determine one's character, or an originating character that each one begins with. Either option makes free will impossible. So a response that could be given to this in light of the view of free will that I presented tonight: one's character is underdetermined regarding human action. There is no maximally determinate character, but rather it narrows the ranges of actions by making certain actions more or less probable. So this is the idea of character as sort of a path of least resistance for action. The complete cause of a free action is the person, who is more than merely his or her character. So here's the final criticism that you see is once again from a philosophical perspective. It's called free choice as a function of luck. And I've intimated this argument throughout this lecture. If there are no discrete and prior conditions that cause a free action, then it follows that the action itself is not under the control of the agent, but is random instead. But if an event is random, how can we say that it is also an autonomous act of the agent? So my response to this is, there is a distinction between a general versus a particular cause for an event, and there is a specific relationship between these two types of causes. There is a discrete and prior general cause accounting for an act of free choice, which is the whole person via the will and the intellect. This is the idea of agent causation in conjunction with the unique powers of the will and the intellect. The particular and material cause, comes back here, is the indeterminate interactions at the level of the brain. The general causation framework within the framework of the of the bottom up and the side to side situation described earlier. Sorry, that didn't make any sense. The bottom up provides the fundamental reason, and the side to side provides the specific concrete execution of one of the abstract pathways. This is a higher actuality that resides in the delicate and indeterminate situation that exists at the fundamental level of the brain as potency. So in other words, at the higher level of actuality, you have the bottom-up, top-down thing with the intellect, the side-to-side with the will, and then it acts upon, sort of situated in the environment of the brain, that requires a certain level of indeterminism at the physical level to be able to work with that that action at the level of the soul. So, in other words, even though there is indeterminism at the level of the brain and there's a particular causation that is random at that level, because there is a higher accounting for that is based on doing something for a reason, etc., it defends itself from the criticism that the action is truly random, right? Because there will be a reason for the action. All right. Thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to the discussion. You guys are a patient audience.
Yeah, so I'm not done. We have time for questions if you want. Go for it.
Maybe you guys can help me with what I, for me to understand what I just said to you. Yeah.
I actually had a question on slide 18 when we were talking about the nature and so we were talking about the nature and possibility.
Good memory.
Yeah. One thing that I was actually curious about is we didn't actually go into explaining it, but I noticed that you said that it's ordered to the necessary goal of objective happiness.
Yeah.
And there's that's kind of a big thing that you just put into a sentence with probably no justification because it's like it's hard to explain, but I was wondering if we could briefly go into, like, how is that necessary?
So how is it, so can you rephrase your question? So why say
that
our happiness is necessary?
Like, not only that, but I remember earlier, I think in slide 11, you also talked about how our reason, like, we cannot reason to do evil or something along those lines, which I thought was really interesting.
Yes, good. Yeah, let me explain that a little bit. So there's a distinction between we can do evil, but we can't do evil because it's evil, right? So there'll be a distinction between doing something, we'll always be doing something under the aspect of some good, okay? So I should stop using this example because, you know, it could get me in trouble one day. But let's say, you know, I knock off my wife to collect the insurance payout, right? So on this view, me doing that would be doing something under the aspect of some good, right? Namely, money is a good thing, right? I get money from that. I need money, and we recognize that as a good thing. Now, of course, it's not objectively good. It's not an integrated to my happiness, to my fullest realization as a human person in that more deeply integrated and rational way. And so your happiness is an objective, full thing that you are striving for, the full fulfillment of yourself. But that doesn't exclude the possibility of doing evil things. So the key distinction is this, doing something that is actually good and actually contributes to your happiness, and that which you think is. You know, you haven't thought things through well enough. And by the way, I left out the whole problem of sin and evil and all that stuff out of this because it is a...
It's
tricky. It really is. Yeah.
But thanks. That answers my question.
Good.
Thanks to Sam Harris.
Yeah.
Slide. Could you?
Which one?
I think.
Microterminism or macro?
Macro. Yeah. Was the response that it sounded like you were saying that it's not macro determinism because it's coming from the soul? Is that?
Let me see. So you're talking about...
No, not this one, the second one.
Oh, this one.
Yeah.
This one, right. That we're not the conscious source, that we're not the source of most of our thoughts and actions.
Yeah, but then your response is that we are the source?
We're not. I think if you take out conscious source, I think it makes all the difference. I think it's something that you can live with. You can say, well, we're not the conscious source. In other words, we don't, all of our thoughts, we don't sort of pull from the head of Zeus from our own thought. That's kind of a weird idea, right?
So are you saying...
But they come from us as a whole.
So you're saying, the unconscious is free.
Yeah, so okay, yeah. So the unconscious and all that stuff, right, is one continuous human person with lower potentialities and higher actualities that work together. So I think part of it in the background here is this strong bifurcation that you get with Freud, who's super fascinating to read, right? If you read these case studies, it's sort of like, it's like an academic version of Jerry Springer, right? You're just like, what are you reading? I'm actually reading the case studies of Freud. Oh, you're a very smart individual. It's actually very, interesting reading. But anyways, he consciously sets the unconscious over and against the conscious. And so you have things like intellectual operation and, reasoning and this sort of thing as sort of playing out in opposition to the deep desires of the id, right, that are ultimately contrary there. But I think if it all comes down to sex for Freud, and I think maybe a hylomorphic view is that, yeah, sexuality, for example, will be something that's integrated to, things like decisions and judgments and, things like the various ways that we interact at that level. So I think that the opposition is the problem. And so if we take out the conscious part and say, yeah, I am the source of my thoughts and actions in the present, but I'm not just my consciousness. It's a deeper notion of the human person.
I guess my question is sort of how if we're born into a certain unconscious,
yeah,
we don't control the unconscious that we're born into. So how is it free if we're born into a body that we don't control, its biological predispositions,
yeah,
and that kind of thing?
Well, so but from my understanding of Freud, and I know it doesn't just begin and end with Freud, but he starts getting at the deep, dark notion of the unconscious from just talking about the preconscious, which is just a function, it's your functional memory, right? Where, you're busy thinking about one thing at a particular time, you have to push things off to the side there, right? And so if you sort of have a view of conscious and the subconscious, not as sort of, I don't see why... for example, I don't see why the thing that you've pushed off into the periphery of your memory isn't still not your thought. And if it comes to consciousness, how's that not your thought that's come into consciousness from these autonomous functions of the brain? I might be missing something, but I don't see that as being a problem. I do think, though, that there's a kind of snowball theory about these thoughts, and that was what I was trying to get to here, is my thoughts of the present are often thoughts and decisions of the past that I made, right? And certainly there's going to be cases where there might be things that are compulsive things, right? And I think at that point you maybe want to say this has an extrinsic source, some kind of bodily, maybe even defective source of this idea, and then you don't have to own those. But when they come into consciousness, right, then what you do with them will then create a history with those compulsive ideas. So it's very complicated. Yeah.